And we're going to move on now. I think we've all seen sort of the increased proliferation of magnetic GE junction reinforcement for GERD. And whenever new procedures come along, the questions about what do you do when these operations fail, or how do you pick the right people for these operations, become really important questions. So Brian Louie from Seattle, Washington is going to talk to us about that.
Kyle, Daniela, thanks for the invitation and to the college for speaking about mechanisms of failure after magnetic sphincter augmentation. These are my disclosures. The most relevant one is I have a restricted research grant from J&J and Torax Medical, makers of the Lynx device. In 2012, the FDA approved this new device, the magnetic sphincter augmentation, or what we know as the Lynx device, for implantation for reflux patients in the United States. And as you know, it has a magnetic core, it's encased in titanium, and it's built on titanium struts, so that when it's closed, it provides high resistance, but provides no compressive force on the esophagus. And when it's open, it provides lower resistance and allows the food bolus to pass. And over the last 5+ years, multiple studies have shown some very balanced outcomes, with consistent rates of PPI utilization post-Lynx at about 15%, reflux control approaching that of Nissen fundoplication, but a superior ability to belch and vomit compared to fundoplication, and when compared to a partial, seems to have the same quality of life. But on the other side, there are dysphagia rates that are similar to the fundoplication, and there is a consistent erosion risk of about 0.3%. Lastly, the reoperative intervention rate is estimated at about 3%. And so while we have pretty good outcomes, I think there are opportunities for improvement. This is a study that we did looking at outcomes primarily directed at reflux control, and you can see that we defined excellent outcomes as people had reported no symptoms on the GERD HQRL, were not on PPI therapy, and had no esophagitis, whereas people who had a poor outcome had a GERD HQRL was greater than 25, were on PPIs at least daily or greater, and had grade C or D esophagitis. And what we identified was that about 75% of patients had a good to excellent outcome. But that left about 25% who just really were fair to poor at best. With that focus on reflux, we sort of ignored some of the other things. And if you look at the reported reasons for removal, you see other things that people are experiencing. This is a study by C. Dan Smith using the MAUDE database, the manufacturer's database that allows you to track complications. And in about 3,300 patients who underwent Lynx, the explant rate was about 3%. And what you notice is that at 57% of these patients had an explant at 1 year, and the dominant symptom for explant at 1 year was dysphagia. And as you move forward to years 1 and 2, 30% of the patients got explanted during that time, and it's more equal between dysphagia and the redevelopment of GERD. And at 3 years, the implant or the explant removal is smaller, but it's starting to be more likely to be GERD-related, though dysphagia still has a role to play in there. When you look at a multi-institution study, this is the FDA-mandated trial where they got approval on 100 patients. Dysphagia is the dominant symptom for which explant was undertaken, and there was a 7% explant rate in that study. If you look at a single institution study, this is the Italian group, 164 implants, slightly different. Their primary reason for explant was GERD, followed by dysphagia, and their explant rate was closer to the 7% range, and they reported 2 erosions in that particular series. They also looked at the likelihood of removal, and that likelihood occurs less than 24 months after implantation, and they recommended reevaluation with persistent symptoms or new symptoms after a 6-month follow-up visit, and went back to the usuals that Dr. Dunst was talking about, a barium, manometry, pH testing, and an upper endoscopy to get a better sense of what was going on. If we look closer at some of these symptoms, such as dysphagia, you'll note that in this study, this was the FDA-mandated post-approval study that Torax was required to complete, that enrolled 200 patients in 12 institutions across the United States. 82 patients who had no dysphagia pre-op developed dysphagia in a post-operative setting, of which 30 at 12-month follow-up still had persistent dysphagia. Most of that dysphagia, based on the GERD HQRL, was noticeable, but really not bothersome, didn't interfere with their daily activities, but there was some that had persistent dysphagia that was fairly significant, requiring dilation in 13 of these patients. But fortunately, single dilation resolved most of that dysphagia in 77% of patients. But as you know, early on, we repaired hernias that were less than 3 for implantation. But as the hernia size is increased, people are interested, is there more dysphagia in these patients who have had hernia sizes 3 to 7 centimeters? This is John Lipham's paper looking at their outcomes in larger hiatal hernias and involved full dissection of the hiatus, restoration of length. And what's in here is of interest is that of the 47 patients who had follow-up, 6 developed persistent dysphagia for a rate of 13%. 4 of the 6 required a single dilation with complete resolution of their symptoms. But 2 of those patients had 4 dilations, and one of them had to have their device removed because of persistent dysphagia. And in Dr. Lipham's analysis of this, they reported that they thought that these rates were higher because of the full dissection of the hiatus compared to those that we didn't dissect the hiatus. And in my take on that is I think it's really the hiatal closure that drives some of this postoperative dysphagia when you get these larger hernias that are repaired. We know that dysphagia is bimodal in implanting Lynx devices. There's the early postoperative phase, which typically occurs around the 10-day mark, which is related to encapsulation as part of the healing process for implantation of the device. It's almost always self-limiting, and most Lynx surgeons have gone to sort of a rehabilitation type diet where they have people eating small amounts of food fairly frequently to make the device open and close as many times as they can so that that healing process goes through with that. In refractory cases, we'll use a short course of steroids, but rarely do we dilate folks in this early postoperative period. The second mode of dysphagia is really those patients who have persistent dysphagia after the healing period. And what I found is it's predominantly solid food dysphagia. It often responds to telling people to slow down because they are so used to eating quickly that if they don't slow down, they will get dysphagia. These are the folks that respond to dilation, and occasionally they will require further evaluation if they're still persistent, as you've seen in the prior studies. But the one that's most important for surgeons who do place Lynx or who do not place Lynx is the patient who presents with new onset or recurrent dysphagia that went away. This requires evaluation, in my opinion, because you're likely to see, like on the left picture, transmediastinal herniation, or on the right, you might see erosion. And so an upper GI, upper endoscopy, with or without manometry, are usually our go-to evaluation tools in this particular situation. In C. Dan Smith's study of 3,000 patients in the MOD database, they identified an erosion rate of 0.15%, and these are the patients that they identified. Most commonly, the devices were smaller. The patients almost always presented with new onset dysphagia, and they occurred within the first 2 years, and most of the removals of these devices occurred either with endoscopy alone or a laparoscopy. But a consortium of people took this to a worldwide worldwide study just recently and looked at almost 9,500 patients who had Lynx implantation by the end of 2017, and this includes all 10,000 devices that were implanted worldwide. And they identified 29 erosions between the MOD database and Torax's database, for which they kept fairly good records. And that led to the 0.3% risk of erosion. You can see that the erosions, which we thought were really going to be in the first 2 years, are really spread out between 0 to 1 through 4 to 5. And again, but the symptoms that present are new onset dysphagia and chest discomfort are the ones that drive the identification of these particular patients. The erosion risk, as we also know, is influenced by the size of the device. And you can see that the erosion risk for the 12B device was 5%. And that device, as you know, has also been subsequently taken out of Torax's armamentarium, so the smallest device you can get is 13 beads. And you can see that as the bead sizes increase, the erosion risk starts to fall. Similarly, based on a Kaplan-Meier curve, erosion risk diminishes over time, but I would caution folks that you know, 5 years, we haven't seen in the United States more than 5 years of data. We're at 6, and the question is what will happen in years 5 through 10? We don't know. If you find one of these, the techniques of removal have been listed as the following: endoscopic partial removal with delayed laparoscopic completion, and this is a patient of mine, it's one of our only erosions. You can see that we've left 5 beads left intact. We let him heal up and then we took it out laparoscopically. If you can get it out endoscopically with your GI colleagues or by yourself, that's great. Some people have done a single stage combined endoscopic laparoscopic approach. Rarely is a laparoscopy done on its own, and somebody tried a transgastric approach to one of these in the data. Couple things to know about endoscopic removal. It's important to know which device has been implanted in the patient. So the early devices, the devices that were approved for 0.7 Tesla MRIs, these can be easily cut with the Olympus endoscopic scissor. You can see a picture of that there. But in the newer devices that are 1.5 Tesla, there is concern, and folks have reported the Olympus endoscopic scissors will not cut the new barbed wire, the new struts. So people have tried the Ovesco clip cutter. There is a report in Dr. Ali Cuban's paper of a new device that's being manufactured. I've not seen that. But at least for the one that we've removed, we use the endoscopic lithotripter that our GI colleagues had, and that looks like this. You can see in the top left panel, hopefully the endoscope device going through, there's the Lynx device, and we passed a wire on one side of the Lynx device. And we've retrieved that wire, a thick jag wire, and brought it around the device, and you can see the two arrows on the middle panel at the top showing the wire going back up the esophagus. And there's the hand crank lithotripter device that brings the two wires through there is attached to the crank. We advance that back down under fluoroscopy, and then as we tighten up the wire, we snap the strut so we can open it up, and then we simply grasped it with a snare and removed it. This, for us, has been fairly successful, but an N of one experience, I'm not sure would count on that, but it seems to work just fine without having to buy anything new. Let's switch gears a little bit and talk about just how to manage reflux that occurs post-magnetic sphincter augmentation. This is, again, data from the mandated FDA post-approval study that shows on all elements of the, or all components of the Demeester score, that there's significant improvement in each of them across the board. But that still left us in this 200-patient series with about three-quarters of patients having a normalized pH score, or percent time pH less than 4 normal, and an overall Demeester score normalized at about 72%. So by calculation, that left us with about 55 patients who had a positive pH test, because in that series, not everybody got a pH test, almost everybody, but not everybody. But of the 55 that we know, 25% of them only took a PPI, so about half the patients who had pH positive Zs took a PPI. Most of that was daily, a third of them took it once in a while, and there was a smaller percentage of patients who are on BID PPI therapy. Why might we get reflux post-magnetic sphincter augmentation? Well, this is some of the work we did looking at the role of the lower esophageal sphincter. And you can see that across the top, if you had a normal lower esophageal sphincter as defined by pressure, overall length, and intra-abdominal length, versus you had a defective sphincter with one defect or two defects, the likelihood that we are going to achieve normalization or return to normal of the lower esophageal sphincter gets less and less the more defective your sphincter is. And as such, the ability to have pH control, particularly in the right group where the sphincter was most effective, was much less successful than if you had a normal sphincter going in. And so there's something about that that drives post-MSA GERD. We also have looked at the role of the hiatal hernia, how it's closed, and as you know, early in the Lynx implantation experience, it was a minimal dissection. And many surgeons have moved to the formal hiatal dissection that we use for fundoplication, and you can see that in the minimal dissection group, which is the purple bars, compared to the formal curl closure, full dissection, which is in the green bars, the formal closure actually does better at normalizing the Demeester score, particularly if you don't have a hiatal hernia. And it beats on all levels all the other types of closure. But when you get a larger hiatal hernia, the ability to normalize the pH on a Demeester score gets less. John Lipham's group also took a different take on this because they looked at it without pH scores. They looked at just symptom-based diagnosis of recurrence. They looked at minimal dissection and full closure in around 200 patients. And they too identified that minimal dissection had a higher rate of redevelopment of reflux symptoms. They had more dysphagia. Their PPI use was higher, though not statistically significant. They had a higher or persistent rate of hiatal hernias, and they had more revisions in the group that had a minimal dissection. And when they factored out just hernias that were less than 2 centimeters, it's really the thing that comes out still is that the recurrent or persistent hiatal hernia still dominates in that minimal dissection group. And I think it has to relate to sort of this finding, which is, I think if you don't repair it, you still have further progression and deterioration of the hiatus. This is a patient of mine who had minimal dissection early on in our series. And you can see at year one, normal looking valve, the device is there, the Rugel folds are all below, but as you get to year 2 in 2017. The Demeester score now becomes 1 day positive, 1 day negative, and you can see the Rugel Fords heading up into that hiatal canal. And by year 3, I've got 2 really significantly positive days. I have a hiatus that doesn't look anything like I left it, and I suspect because we didn't address something underlying in that original implantation technique. And so for patients who have post-MSA GERD symptoms, PPIs most commonly are used, most of them PRNs, some daily, rarely BID, and I think the combination or the hybrid approach is actually reasonable because the patient's regurgitation symptoms are generally well controlled. It's just the burning that they are concerned about. I have found that few patients wish to remove it and they would rather take a small amount of PPI than remove the device, but if they are, I think pH manometry are important. You can take it out, you can convert them to a toupee partial or a Nissen. And somebody has suggested maybe you should repair the hiatus alone, though I've not been bold enough to try it yet. As you know, there is a movement and some surgeons who are placing Lynx devices in larger parasophageal hernia repairs. I have been generally reluctant in my own practice to sort of take that on outside of a study, partly because I have been the recipient of several other surgeons' patients who look like this after they've repaired a large hiatal hernia and put a Lynx device in. This is a frail old lady who had a large hiatal hernia repair, Lynx placed, and this is what she looks like 1 year after the Lynx device, erosive esophagitis, a big hernia recurrence. And so I've been a little reluctant to sort of move that way, and outside of a study, I'm not necessarily prepared to do it. But I do applaud Tripp Buckley, Reg Bell for looking at this in 200 patients that they used for large hiatal hernias and they put the Lynx device in. And at their 6 to 9 month follow-up, they had an 8% recurrence of transmediastinal herniation or recurrent hiatal hernia. That's the left picture. But I will remind you, my esteemed colleague at the end, Dr. Oschlager, published his original series with mesh and large hiatal hernia repair. He also reported an exactly 8% recurrence rate at 6 months. And we all know that in his 5-year follow-up study, that recurrence rate was much higher. So I think if you're doing larger hiatal hernias with Lynx, I would encourage you to capture data because we need to know the answer to this. Is it going to be less? Is it going to be more? Is it going to be the same? I think time will tell. There is also the risk of vomiting. You know, you can vomit with a Lynx device, but this is a patient of mine. Post-op looked good. 1 year looked good. 5 years, got food poisoning and post-viral gastroenteritis all at the same time, and his Lynx device is now in his chest after 3 days of vomiting. So you can have these late recurrences of transmediastinal herniation from vomiting. Treatment of this, I think, is dependent heavily on symptoms. I think you can redo the hiatal hernia repair. You can leave the device intact. You can redo it, convert it to a funduplication. You can redo it and recite it. These have all been reported in the literature, but there's no data that supports one versus the other, and there's certainly no long-term data about what to do. There are some rare things that we have seen. You can develop new onset motility disorders. That's not uncommon even for funduplication. These are rare. They present with dysphagia, waves of spasm. Barium manometry and upper GI are helpful. And the treatment, as far as I can tell, is removal of the MSA device. This is a patient of mine who on postoperative day 7 still had a column of barium that wouldn't clear and developed really what we thought was early onset pseudoachalasia after the device was put in. It took her 6 months to resolve this once we took the device out. We've also seen the development of delayed gastric emptying, for which I don't know what the incidence is. But they present with vomiting, nausea, and reflux, much like Dr. Dunst showed earlier. And I'm not sure of the treatment. We've used standard things. This is the one patient in our 200 series that had developed delayed emptying within 6 months after having had his device placed. So a rare event, but certainly a feasible possibility. And we conclude by saying that the mechanisms of failure are common post-magnetic sphincter augmentation. I thought they would really all be related to the first 2 years, but as data is coming out, they can occur late. Dysphagia and recurrent reflux are the most common presenting symptoms and I think need to be evaluated. Erosion remains uncommon at 0.3%, but presents with dysphagia and most of the time is treated endoscopically. And so my take-home point is that new symptoms after magnetic sphincter augmentation really demand evaluation. Thank you.